Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Before introducing today's guest, I feel like I need to make a brief apology. During the latter portion of last week's program with guest Dr. Kevin Folta, I interrupted a comment by a caller named Terry. It was inappropriate for many reasons, but principally because it prevented open discussion and it was rude. Line One works hard to provide local and national healthcare experts who provide reliable healthcare information. In addition, we are trying to apply critical thinking to guest and listener comments to help our listeners make better healthcare decisions. But how can you critically evaluate the comments of others if they're not allowed to complete their thoughts? For this interruption, I apologize to Terry and to all Line One listeners. So today's guest is University of Louisiana Monroe psychologist, Dr. Brian Bramstead. Our topic today are myths in popular psychology. If you know of a comment or a thought that you think might be a myth, this would be a good time to give us a call or shoot us an email. You can reach us in Anchorage at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, and all one word, line1 at kska.org. Dr. Bramstead, welcome to Line One.
Good to be here. Good to be here.
We need to, or I need to start by making a bias in the program. You used to be a patient of mine. You lived down the street from me, as a matter of fact. I could probably hit a baseball from my house to your house. How you doing?
This is true. I remember you doing a few house calls when we had a little bit of trauma going on. So that was always appreciated. Good to hear from you. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I get the chance to talk with you today, and the next week we're going to talk with another Anchorageite who now lives in Homer, an author. So it's really a special treat to be able to do this. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got from Anchorage to the University of Louisiana in Monroe.
Well, I just kept heading south. I graduated from West High and back in 97. And went to Michigan State for psychology, and then on to grad school, got my PhD in developmental psychology at the University of Toledo. And from there, I had a lectureship position at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, their flagship campus. And now I'm in a tenure-track position in developmental psychology with the University of Louisiana. So I just keep heading south.
What's your special interest? What's your background? And then kind of what's the big emphasis in what you're doing day-to-day right now?
Yeah, as an undergrad, it's just a general degree in psychology, a BS or a BA. In grad school, though, I focused on early development within children. I did everything from perceptual development studies with 4 and 8-month-olds, categorization stuff with 2-year-olds, but the main emphasis was on language acquisition, actually, with anywhere from around 2 to 5 years of age. Essentially, how do kids get really good, really fast at learning language, which they definitely do. Here, I'm the developmental guy. I teach sometimes childhood classes, adolescence, lifespan, which goes all the way into geriatrics. So, it's a great deal and a very exciting topic.
What I usually like to do is start off with some definitions so it's clear what we're going to be talking about today. And since I mentioned the idea that we're going to talk about myths in pop psychology, maybe we should define perhaps as best we can what we mean by pop psychology.
Okay, yeah, that's a good idea. Pop psychology, they run the gamut, anything from, you know, old wives' tales to just general cultural beliefs about, you know, how the mind works and so on and so forth. And as a professor, one of, you know, particularly in introductory courses, you know, one of the great challenges is to actually break down these well-established notions about, you know, how people think and how genetics works and how you are the person that you are as far as functioning. because there's a lot of things that we, you know, on a day-to-day basis believe to be true that simply aren't. And that can be, you know, at its worst, very, very dangerous. At its least, it's just not educated. So,
can you give us a specific example of what you would say is a pop psychology that seems to be maybe commonly believed, but really doesn't stand up to scrutiny?
Yeah, one of my favorites, and it's kind of a hot button issue if you're into politics, as I am. Recently, we have a lot of discussion about homosexuality in society, exactly what rights and privileges should be allowed, you know, by law. And in particular, there's a lot of rumbling about, you know, marriage amendments, where states are coming in and trying to alter their constitutions in a way that you can't even put an amendment in potentially in the future to allow these sorts of things. And when you talk to people, there's a lot of a lot of misinformation about the nature of homosexuality. For example, that it's learned, that you can be converted. One of the great fears, you know, almost like a training or anywhere from like a being taught to be gay to almost a viral thing. You know, cough, cough, cough. Now your child's homosexual. And these notions are incredibly, incredibly off base. I don't know if we're lighting up your phone bank right now, but we definitely get into those types of notions in the classroom. It's a big topic of debate.
I know when I have been faced in the pediatric office with a family, a parent who has concerns about their child's sexuality, often sometimes very early by their preferences. For example, a boy who prefers to play with girls or play with dresses or play with dolls, that my research, my reading into this is, and here's again where I'm trying to, you correct me, because I don't want to miseducate anybody either, is that one, you don't know where that's going to go. And two, you can't necessarily change it. You may do more harm. And three, what you need to do is give that child universal love and support to have the best outcomes. Your comments?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, playing with dolls, I mean, the only difference between a Barbie doll and a G.I. Joe doll is one has long hair and the other one has a machine gun. Uh-huh. So, and interest in things that aren't necessarily gender stereotype is a fairly normal occurrence. You do tend to see signs fairly early on, but you know, often the question is, you know, what can I do to make that stop? Which I would argue is a highly destructive way of going about that. These individuals need to find out who they are for themselves, and again, you know, love and support and be decent, and everything comes out in the end. I remember a radio program where a woman was talking about her son had come out of the closet, and somebody else called in and said, you know, what's your greatest fear? What are you most worried about? And her response, you know, no moral issues, no anger toward him, but what the public would respond, you know, the type of life that individual would live with, you know, overt discrimination. And I thought that was a pretty profound answer. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They've had all sorts of studies, everything from electroshock to diabetic-induced diabetic reactions, aversion therapy, you name it. And the only thing they've really ever had any success when trying to make people un-gay is to make depressed gay people. Mm-hmm. It just simply doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Which is enough of a problem often for someone who has a gay or homosexual a tendency. I mean, they have enough difficulty struggling with, as you said, discrimination and things like that, I guess.
Yeah, it's you know, America is. The vast majority, around 75% of Americans, are not accepting of homosexual behavior. It's fairly universally panned as being, not good. And as a child, you're raised often in these families to, fear and hate, which, again, pop psychology, it's just not really understood what this is all about. And kids are not sexual. As much as Freud and other early theorists got into that, they're not. I remember as a child, I was walking down the street with my father, and there were two men holding hands, and I was a little child, probably four or five, and I said, "Hey, Dad, what's that?" And he said, "Oh, they're homosexual." And I said, "Well, what's that mean?" And he said, "Well, okay, they're like your mother and I, but they're guys." And I smiled, and I looked at him, and I said, Am I homosexual? And I remember he looked at me and he smiled and he says, "Well, son, I don't know. We'll find out." And obviously, I wasn't. But it's an interesting thing because as you figure out who you are sexually, a lot of these individuals find out that they are something that they were taught to fear and dislike, and that's incredibly depressing. It's the suicide rate. Or the attempted suicide rate is something along the lines, I think, of 1 in 4 or 1 in 5, which that's epidemic proportion. Mm-hmm. Something's wrong.
Let me take just a second to remind our listeners, again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Brian Bramstead. We're kind of addressing some common beliefs or psychological myths and trying to see what evidence there may be or whether or not these ideas will stand up to scrutiny. If you've got questions or comments, it's easy to reach us. You can call us locally at 550-8433, 550-8433. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address during the next hour is line1@kska.org. And we'll take our first guest right now, a telephone call. Jeff, you're on line one.
Hi, I'm extremely heterosexual. I've even, because I've had friends over the years, I'm almost 70, and over the years I grew up in New York City, and I've had homosexual friends almost all my life. I mean, if I think back, further back I think, the more I realize so-and-so was probably homosexual. But the reason I called is, I mean, I wanted to make that clear. I'm not like I'm defending us or anything like that. I don't understand what the problem is that people have with homosexuals. I mean, it's like my own personal conclusion, and this is probably not scientific, but my conclusion is they need someone to dump on. Excuse me for using the N-word, but it's like, okay, we can't say all that nasty stuff about black people. Let's say it about homosexuals. I was going to use the N-word, but yeah. I decided not to.
Yeah.
So it's, and my reality is, it's none of anybody else's business what two people do in private with each other if no one is injured and no one is harmed. Mm-hmm. And this nightmare, stupid rumor going around that I've heard for decades that it's like we can't let homosexuals into the classroom because they're going to pervert our children. First of all, that's nonsense. Secondly, if you look at the data, well over 80, probably over 90% of all the child molesters are declared heterosexuals. So it's not, want to protect our children from sexual abuse, then only hire homosexual teachers. I mean, it's just like, it's crazy. The whole thing, it's like not based in fact. And I don't understand why these people get so vehement to dump on and attack and go forth and find and persecute people that are homosexual. My only conclusion is there is something internally wrong with those folks or in their family, and they are just distracting themselves by finding some sort of, I don't know what the word would be, enemy, target, that they can point to and make a big righteous indignation thing because somehow at some subliminal level they're distracting themselves from their own failings and problems. What people do in private with each other, homosexual, heterosexual, is none of my business, and in fact, none of anybody's business except the people involved, unless someone gets hurt or injured, and then it's not even my business. It's the criminal justice system if damage is done to somebody.
Let's ask Dr.
I just wanted to say that. It's not that there's a myth. I just don't understand it. Maybe you can address that.
Yeah.
And I'll take my answer off the phone unless you want me to stay on for some reason.
Why don't you do that? And we'll ask Dr. Bramstedt his thoughts.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for calling,
Bye.
Jeff.
Bye.
Dr. Bramstedt.
Yes. No, I hear your frustration and of the caller, and I think you're onto something. It's scapegoating. Often, it's the blaming of a group. It's venting of anger. It's displacement. It's displacement. And I think a lot of times, this is a highly political issue. And when you have, issues that need to be discussed in the political forum, it's often a lot easier to rile people up about something that they have a visceral reaction about to kind of cloud maybe some of the other things that we should probably be talking about. So we prey on stereotypes, smoke and mirrors, and it's great political fodder to, again, obscure much more important things. The comment about children is interesting. I think there's a confusion about homosexuality and pedophilia. A pedophile is an adult that likes children in an inappropriate sexual way. Homosexual men like men, just like a straight person likes individuals of the opposite sex. Hey, I'm a straight guy. I don't like little girls. I like women. And I think that's a distinction that a lot of people don't quite get straight. They don't quite seem to understand. One of the big ones, you look at banned books, there's the My Two Mommies, My Two Daddy kind of series that were disseminated throughout libraries. And how dare we do this? And that doesn't sit well. And one of the individuals that are often against that will say is, as parents, you need to indoctrinate children into proper gender roles, quote unquote, whatever that means, even though androgyny, i.e. being both feminine and masculine, is a very psychologically positive thing. But that maybe, whatever child, if raised by homosexuals, won't understand if it's two lesbians, what a man does, or if it's two men, they won't understand women's roles in society. And it's just simply not the case. You are surrounded, you are inundated from the moment you wake up to the time you fall asleep at night with all sorts of models. It just doesn't hold up. And again, infection, some sort of a communicable condition, which again, adoptive studies indicate that more or less likely to have homosexual individuals raising a homosexual child than members of the straight population. So again, misinformation, it's manipulated fear.
No, it's I use this example or talk like this a lot, and I don't want to wear it down, but the first thing that comes to my mind when we talk about this is a book called The Demon Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Darkness. And the history of civilization is that we do see things and misattribute what's going on. And what science has finally began to do, beginning in the period of the Enlightenment, early, late 1600s, 1700s, was to ask the question, what's the evidence for these things, and asking everyone to begin to, think about things and not just accept what we've been told and what we've seen. And so inevitably, when you look at these comments, like what we've heard Jeff talk about with beliefs and thoughts about homosexuality, the issue has to be raised is where's the evidence? And what I'm hearing you say is, realistically, when you look at it and you know how to evaluate good evidence, because there's lots of evidence. In fact, some people say it ought to be science-based, not just evidence-based, because there's a lot of lousy evidence people use. But we are, through this way of thinking, beginning to throw away a lot of that darkness, that slowly misunderstanding, and it's slowly we're kind of in continuing the Enlightenment. It's the way I like to think of this whole idea.
Absolutely, absolutely. Knowledge is power, and we want to understand, you know, how does this phenomena work? What's the angle? You know, from an evolutionary standpoint, there's not really a lot of adaptive characteristic of not being heterosexual. I mean, the goal is to provide genetic material, as many little half copies of yourself as possible. And, that doesn't really hold up if you look at it scientifically, which people will say, well, not genetic. Some of the newest research, actually, on, you know, how does this happen, why does this happen, tends to be, particularly in the case of men, I've had fun with this where I'll meet a gay man and I'll say, so you got older sisters, and their eyes get big and they say, how'd you know that? And what they're finding is a lot of times women that are pregnant, multiple pregnancies with carrying girls, it alters the woman's body, the hormone mix, in utero in a way that sets up a pregnancy that it's essentially chemically very similar to what you'd find if she were carrying a girl, but she's not. And so we have this often feminization within the womb. So, yeah, we need that info. We need to figure this out and you know, be able to say, well, okay, here's really what's going on. Here's why that happened. And, you know, I object to the term choice. You know, choice is I'd like a cheeseburger, but a chicken sandwich would be okay, too. This didn't quite work that way.
I am not an expert, and I don't want to continue. We don't need to beat this homosexuality misunderstanding too much. But I recall also looking at some recent research that the evidence of this study or in a review of a bunch of evidence is that sexual preference is really more of a bell-shaped curve, like much of psychology, and that there are people who are entirely, you know, unisexual, and then a lot of people are somewhere in between, and then there's those individuals who have a preference for opposite sex, and it's a gradation, or as I said, mm-hmm. a bell-shaped curve, more than it's really an all-or-none phenomenon, which is so often the case in biology.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is very spectral, very spectral. I believe, particularly for women, who often will vacillate before finally going one direction or the other. You see less of that with homosexual men, but definitely, I agree 100% with you.
I got one down here. Spare the rod, spoil the child. Hopefully, that doesn't need a lot of evidence, but perhaps we ought to talk about that particular psychological, or that belief. Let's put it that way right now.
Okay, a discipline type thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Saying that you should be, you know, it implies that corporal punishment, spanking, will work, and that if you don't do that, you're actually spoiling the child.
Yeah, the origins of that particular term, people spare the rod, spoil the child. What that came from, that term was, you spare the rod, you spoil the child. Well, a rod is a staff. And a staff is something carried by a shepherd. And what that originally meant was, if you don't bring children up in church, you end up with rotten children. So the original reference had zippity-doo-dah nothing to do with actually using physical punishment against a child. And in reality land, spanking. There's a fine line between discipline and abuse. And once you get into physical means of correction, it's a fine line. People make the greatest mistake, I believe, in that as they punish, they're angry. You know, you get that, if you do that, and every time it's accentuated with a spanking, with a contact of a hand or something. And often when you do that, you're teaching, okay, I'm mad. And when I get mad, I get violent. And so you start to program your children into, you know, anger begets violence. And that's really the wrong message. If you can, discipline is fine, even physical discipline to an extent. It's particularly effective around 2 to 5, much further than that. Well, it definitely falls off. But you gotta, if you're gonna do that, you absolutely need to make sure that you are about as cool as can be, you know, as far as your demeanor. And if you can do that, if you can do it in a collected fashion, that's not always a bad thing. Not always. But again, gray area. It's very specific the way it needs to be done, and you run a greater risk of probably, you know, giving the incorrect message to a child.
Well, we had a quick email from a listener, and he makes the comment, hate has to be taught, homosexuality just happens.
Yes. Absolutely.
All right. Well, it's getting unbelievable to me. We're already at the time for a short break. We need to do that. I want to remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. You can reach us by telephone at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us during this next 30 to 40 minutes at Line 1, LINEONE at KSKA.org. After this break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails and talk with University of Louisiana at Monroe psychologist Dr. Brian Bramstead on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. And before I make any further comments, I want to remember that I've promised to let everyone know about a couple of events that are happening. The Alaska State Medical Association is continuing a group of free health forums Friday, November 12th from 6 to 7 at the BP Energy Center. There will be a free health forum on strokes and heart attacks. And Saturday, November 13th from 12 to 4 at Wendler Middle School, there's a couple of speakers on health, healthy schools, and healthy kids. Claire Barnett is an executive director of the Healthy Schools Network is one speaker. And a guy named Thad Woodard is going to also be talking a little bit about health from the Academy of Pediatrics standpoint. Links to both of these bits of information, if you want more, can be found at kska.org/line1. So you don't need to remember everything. Just go to kska.org/line1 and you can see some information about these two events as well. And finally, November 7th through the 13th is Nurse Practitioner Week. For 30 years, I've had the privilege of working with many excellent, particularly pediatric nurse practitioners. They're a dedicated professional group providing some high-quality, cost-effective, and very personalized care. So I salute them all, and I'm happy to recognize them and to say thanks. Our phone number, again, if you've got questions or comments to our guest, Dr. Brian Bramstead, is 550-8433 here in Anchorage. Our outside number, which is toll-free, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@kska.org. And please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 tonight, you're listening to the recorded broadcast, and there will be no one taking phone calls or answering any emails. Dr. Bramstead, you mentioned that you were a developmental psychologist in most of your training, and you talked about learning, and particularly children's learning and language. So let me ask you a couple of questions that have come up in my practice or that I need to know the answers of myself. The first one would be, does growing up in a bilingual family help or hinder language development? I've often been told or heard that it hindered it. Now my understanding of how the new learning about brain development is, it couldn't be a better time to learn multiple languages.
Yeah, no, that was a very popular question. People would bring, often it was a couple, and usually one was bilingual and the other was not, and I settled a lot of arguments. Bilingualism is interesting in that you've got two really great things going for you as far as teaching children two languages at the same time. One is, as you say, the way that the brain is structured and learns, and it's very plastic when they're young. So it's easy for them to do that, and they can, you know, essentially once they've learned it, they'll be sounding like a native. I mean, if I were to learn French today, I'd go to France, and they would laugh at me and say, "Oh, you're American." Actually, they thought I was German when I was there, but all the same, I sound funny. So that's good. That's good. The other part, which is a little less intuitive, is that one of the great kind of stumbling blocks to language is to understand its abstractness. Right? There's nothing like if you were to take you write the word bird on a blackboard. Next to it, you write the word elephant. There's nothing about the word bird, B-I-R-D, or the letters, the sequence of letters. There's nothing about it that has any characteristic whatsoever connecting it to a bird other than it just stands for that. And that is a little bit difficult for children to look at that, to get that abstraction, which is a big part of language. And when you're learning two languages at the same time, you get them both, and you start to pick up on those notions a little bit faster. For very, very, very early on, there is a period of time where there's confusion because, hey, why are you calling this thing several different labels, and you know what's going on here? Of course, it's confusing, but that period of time is very short-lived, and we find that bilingual children often outperform individuals with language studies who are just single type. There is some research out there that will be opposite of this, but often that's done with individuals who have immigrated to the country often from less than optimal backgrounds, where they didn't have a lot of education, and you know, maybe their primary language is Spanish, and it kind of confuses things. But by and large, yes, absolutely, I endorse this. It seems to be the way that it works.
Another interesting observation that I have noted recently, I would say in the last several years in my practice, and I have yet to take the time to research where it's coming from and whether it's beneficial or not, is many young parents now seem to be teaching their children sign language. It's very common to see children demonstrating that and parents talking about it. And is there any evidence that you're aware of benefit or harm in this? Again, I'm asking purely for my own information on this one because I've not followed this one to its source and looked for evidence yet.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the problem with little children, you know, infants even, they understand their comprehension. When you look at language, is very phenomenal. A little baby, that there's no way she could say door. If you said door, she would look at the door. I mean, they absolutely understand far more than they're capable of actually producing. Literally, the manipulation of the mouth and the tongue and the throat in a way to create language just isn't really there. To an extent, that drives the desire to manipulate yourself to be able to produce. So you're challenged. It's very frustrating if you can't communicate what you want, which drives learning. But absolutely, sign language, their ability to move their hands and arms, and that is there a lot before a lot of spoken language comes, you know, so to speak, online. And it is positive. It keeps them from being frustrated. I witnessed this as, I don't know, maybe you have too, where, you know, a little baby was getting fussy during a research project we were doing. We were working with a 3.5-year-old, and there was a little baby there, and she was fussing, and the mother gestured in a few ways, and the baby, this little arm came up, and the hand manipulated, and I thought, oh, my goodness. And she calmed right down, and I said, what did you tell her? I told her it'd just be a few more minutes. Apparently the child got it. So, yeah, I give that a thumbs up. Absolutely. Okay. Language will come.
All right.
Will not hinder.
Let me remind our listeners again to get in touch with us and ask questions to Dr. Bramstead. You can reach us at 550-8433. That's our toll-free number, 550-8433. For out-of-towners, 1-888-353-5752, and an email address is line1, and you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at ksk.org. We'll be here for the next 20 minutes or so, and if you've got questions or comments, don't hesitate to call or email us. I'm always interested in why our first off, I guess I should back up. I was going to say why our brain can get fool us sometimes, but the point is that I was going to make is that we are often not aware of how fallible our brain might be. And one thing that jumps to my mind, there's several, but one is memory. It's been shown that our memories are really not that accurate, and what our minds have a tendency to do is fill in and blanks and make it so it fits what our belief system is over time. I think that's fair to say, and it so that what we remember from childhood or for distant events really ends up being edited by our brain quite a bit, and is not what really happened. Is that true?
It is very true. memory retrieval is often called is what we call constructive process. You know, contrary to this notion that, you know, people say I have photographic memory, or they'll claim that their memory is really, really great, and some people are better than others, but all the same. You're right. You're absolutely right. Over time, a lot of things do start to fade away, and it's kind of like you're reading a mystery novel, and there's a couple pages missing, and well, you can flip past those missing pages, and you can fairly well infer from the next paragraph what you missed from that, and so you fill in the blanks. Absolutely, you fill in the blanks, and the more you think about it, often the more you tend to lose sight that you really didn't have a clue what was going on with that. One of the really bizarre ones, my students never believe me on this, are things called flashbulb memories. For example, people, you know, if they were alive when Kennedy was assassinated, people will often be able to tell you exactly where they were and what they were doing when they got that news. A more recent thing would be probably, you know, the comparable thing within the last decade would be, you know, September 11th. And you talk to somebody, where were you, what were you doing? They say, I know exactly what, and I was here, and I said this. And they will swear that they do. And the answer is, no, you don't. They've done quite a bit of looking at this, where they'll interview people right after the significant event, and they'll come back, you know, 5 years later and say, do you remember? People, they just swear up and down every detail, like it was yesterday. And you say, okay, go for it. And I'm sorry, it just doesn't work. So absolutely. Even questioning. You know, you show people, an audience, a film of two cars involved in an accident, and you can ask half of them, how fast were the cars going when they touched? And, you know, maybe 5 miles an hour. Yes, the other group, the other half, how fast were they going when they smashed? Those guys tend to upgrade it to, you know, 40 miles an hour. And in their minds, they see exactly what they're saying that they saw, even though it has nothing really to do with what they were shown, which is why you need a good lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, that one of the reasons that this is as important is in legal situations. So often we're testimonies are based on the memory of individuals, which has been shown not to be very accurate. And nowadays, it takes years to get to court, even. So, it's disturbing.
It is. One of our greatest problems. It's an oddball deal. When you look at crossing ethnic boundaries. If you're European American or white, you're probably raised by, you know, white people, and you probably, most of your friends are that, and so you're pretty good at picking out characteristics of other white people of European ancestry. Well, African Americans have a similar thing. They're really in tune with African American features, Asian individuals, and so on and so forth. You run into a really bad deal when you have a crime committed by somebody of an ethnic group that's different than yours, because you'll swear up and down that it's that guy in the lineup when you're really not good at picking these things out, and the wrong guy goes to prison, or the wrong woman goes to prison, because you couldn't do it. But you'd swear that you knew. And that's dangerous.
You can reach us at 550-8433. You're listening to Line 1. Let me remind you once again, if you have emails or questions you'd like to email us, it's line1@kska.org. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. I'm going to stay on the pediatric aspect of things a little bit longer. I've written down the playing Mozart music to infants boosts intelligence, and I'd like to maybe add a corollary thing there, that kids can learn language skills better from a TV or a video or a computer screen than they can from talking to a live person or interacting with a live person. So there's two questions there. Does playing music boost intelligence to infants, and can children learn language better than talking with interacting with a human being?
Well, the first part is kind of interesting. Does classical music boost intelligence in children? It's hard to pull that apart, because individuals who are interested in the well-being of their children and learning are proactive, and thus they play classical music because they think that might work. Well, they're playing classical music, but what else are they doing? There's probably, because they've automatically, by doing that, self-selected or put themselves into a category that says, I really care about my child. And so, does the classical music do it? Or is it part of a greater number of other things that also has that impact? I would say parents that do that are involved parents, and that is probably really the operative ingredient. There was an interesting study that came out a while ago. They were looking at intelligence and correlating it with musical taste. And the most intelligent people there was a pretty good correlation with intelligence and enjoying classical music, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart. At the far end of the other end of the spectrum was a rapper named Lil Wayne, I think, was the name, something like this. I don't know.
You're off my scale here.
So exactly.
You're on your own with the rapper.
Yeah, Lil Wayne. So maybe, I don't know. But I think it's more a case of self-selection as far as the type of parent that you are. Your other question was about learning from you know, TV and those sorts of things. Well, kids are pretty computer and media savvy. Definitely. I think it was the University of Washington had done a study looking at baby Einstein videos, which are just exactly what you're talking about. And they found that the number of hours watching baby Einstein was correlated with actually lower intelligence within the children.
Right.
Disney, who puts that out, became highly incensed and sued the university. They lost that case, but the researchers' conclusion was the more media that children are consuming, probably the less involved parents are. You get the opposite of the, you know, the ones that want to play stuff. Often television, often these movies, watching, you know, Brave Little Toaster 20 times in a row, it's a very passive, you know, similar to sucking one's thumb. You, whatever benefit might have been there often gets washed out, and instead of positive social interaction, you have this mindless, you know, parade of video and colors and sound. It's very soothing. Often individuals that are watching television, they have less brain activity than when sleeping, in many cases. So that, no, I personally would not endorse that. In moderation, perhaps so, but a lot of times it's just a babysitter part too.
Yeah, the Academy of Pediatrics has had a whole subcommittee looking at screen time and so forth, and really, as you said, that one of those classic studies was done at the University of Washington by a guy named Christakis and I think his group, and they, like you said, the more screen time kids had, the less they did, so they're really not doing other things that may stimulate them, and a very important critical time in their development, these early several years, so.
Yep, they develop habits of passive entertainment, and we end up with, you know, obesity and kids that really don't go out and do stuff, and then we wonder why they're hyperactive and, you know, oh man.
Yeah. Here's an email that discusses or asks about a classic test that was done to demonstrate how our minds can fool us, and it revolves around attention and our ability to see everything, and that we, our brain, will think we don't miss much on day-to-day activities and what's going on around us. And it's the classic invisible gorilla video, which is widely available on the internet, and I've been actually trying to get one of the authors who has written a book about a lot of this, which gets to the point of how our minds work and where it can be fooled. But this is a classic video where there's a video where you're watching several people in black and white uniforms, as I recall it, because I did this after I heard about it at a family reunion to see how many people got noticed this. And they're passing a basketball around, and you're asking the listener or the viewer to count the number of the passes that are made by the people in the white uniform, for example. And they do that, and it's not easy to even count it, but so they're watching very closely, and then you ask them at the end some questions like, did you see the gorilla? And in my house, 80% of the people said, what gorilla? And when you go back and look at the video, it is very clear that a person in a gorilla suit walks in the middle of this whole thing, stands there for a couple of seconds and walks out, and nobody sees that because of selective attention. You're trying to focus on what the job is, and you miss other things, which gets to problems with driving and lots of issues. But what's your comments on that?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that video. I watched that. A student sent it to me, and I had no clue what we were getting into with this. And then it said, did you see it? And yeah, as you say, and they played it back, and I'll be darned. You're right. It's focused attention. Your ability to do multiple things at once is finite. Your cognitive load, i.e. how much engagement can you have, how much attentional focus can you put toward any specific task is finite, and we tend to allocate attentional resources toward specific targets. I was watching the guys in the white uniforms pass the ball, and there's basketballs all over, and oh my goodness, and people running around, and so yeah, what gorilla? Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Texting and driving, similar thing. Your equivalent of texting and driving is usually about like having, you know, four or five shots of whiskey or beer or so, and getting behind the wheel. It's absolutely dangerous and toxic. So, but yeah, we only have so much that we can do at any specific time, and when that's focused, when we make a concerted effort, you really, really, really start to see gaps in what we are aware of perceiving.
And by the way, for our listeners, I believe we do have a link to that video. And there are several other similar like videos, but the one you want to really see, which is really produced by the people who did the original study, is a link on kska.org/line1, and it'll get you there. And there's a link to that that video, which I'd encourage people to take a good look at. It's a very profound way of studying the idea that we can, our mind's not foolproof by any means. Now, the person who already knows what the purpose of the video is about are not going to do this. You got to show it to someone who does not and has not seen the video before, obviously, because they'd be biased and would be looking for the right thing and paying more attention.
You've ruined it for them.
I can't believe there's anybody who hasn't seen that video. But anyway, there are, in my family, again, there was in a family reunion, there were 80% or so who had not seen it and never saw the doggone gorilla. So I guess a corollary of all this is common sense is kind of like pop psychology in a way of thinking about it. So does that mean common sense should not be trusted?
Well, if something is hard, we tend not to do it. We tend to take shortcuts. We tend to conserve resources. Resources being, mental expenditure, and that is dangerous. Common sense is very often not common or sensical, and when you don't analyze, when you don't think, when you take those shortcuts, there's the potential that you're not seeing the picture, you're not understanding what's going on, and you blissfully go along, and that's dangerous. That's very, very dangerous. Common sense is often, again, not sensical and generally not common. And again, most of the time that's not a big deal, but it can be dangerous. Absolutely, absolutely.
Here's one that I'm taking from a book. Incidentally, I should mention the book, 50 Great Myths of Popular Psychology, Shattering Widespread Misconceptions About Human Behavior. It's 50 Great Myths of Popular Psychology. The lead author is Scott Lilienfeld, a psychologist at Emory. Anyway,
yes, I know this book.
He says, one of them that I believe that I got from this, in fact, is number 18 in this book, children learn best if teaching styles are matched to their learning styles. I thought that was one of the important ways we should be changing our educational system is to meet the specific needs of individual children. So maybe, I don't know, I may be too far away from your expertise on this, but I thought I'd bring it up and see if you have any comments.
When I attend, I'll go to teaching conferences, and they talk about one of the things they get into are the millennials, i.e., you've got professors that a lot of them have been around for a long time, and you have this disconnect, I think, often between the teacher and the student, where, cell phones and internet and all that sort of technology just often didn't exist for the individuals who are standing behind the podium. And it's almost this, they object, but they usually couch it in, like, the problem with the millennials, which I find very interesting from a teaching perspective, because you need to, I think you do often need, within a college setting, to alter how you do what you do for the audience that you have. I'm not sure if the myth book would agree with me in this particular regard, but you have to cater to your audience. Absolutely, you can't expect them to do what you've done because their background is fundamentally different than often what yours is. And it's, as a teacher, your job to be the best you can in any way that you're able. You're not going to change them, I guarantee it.
Got about 3 minutes or so, and I want to always sum up, but another common myth that I'm pretty well aware of has been destroyed by lots of research, and that's that more things seem to happen when there's a full moon. There's more babies born, there's more ER visits, more car accidents, more fires, more earthquakes, you name it. Everything's been blamed on more full moons, and yet my understanding is
There's no evidence of that, but it's hard to change people's minds. They all, or many, many of us believe that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's self-fulfilling prophecy. You tend to see that which you expect to see. And as you alluded to very, very early in our discussion, if something agrees, it sticks. If something is contrary to your belief, it goes out the window in one ear and out the other. It's the basis of a lot of racism, even. You know, you see something that agrees with your schema or your stereotype, and you go, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. But you see the opposite, and it doesn't register. It doesn't stick because it doesn't agree. And so out it goes.
Yeah, we don't keep track of those things that don't fit with our worldview.
Absolutely not. To do so would maybe make us feel uncomfortable.
All right, so we're down to the last couple minutes. What's the take-home message?
The take-home message: nothing so true that it should not be tested. You gotta consider that. What's going on? How did they do it? No source of information is so great that it is unquestionable. Ask yourself, who's saying this? Ask yourself, why are they saying it? Ask yourself, what do they have to gain by this? And again, a lot of times when something's hard, we don't want to do it. And as I've said a few times, on one end of the spectrum, it might be harmless. On the other, it could be a really big problem.
Brian, thanks very much for taking the time to spend with us today. It's been enjoyable, and I hope we get the chance to talk again sometime. And next time you're in Anchorage, you need to stop by and say hi.
You bet I will, and thank you for having me on the program. It's been an absolute pleasure.
All right. Keep up the good work. We appreciate it once again.
Yes, sir.
All right. My thanks to the University of Louisiana at Monroe psychologist Dr. Brian Bramstead today for discussing some myths that we all have probably fallen into about popular psychology. As I said earlier, next week we're going to be talking with another local individual, Daniel Coyle. Daniel is the son of a local radiologist who is an author who now lives in Homer, Alaska. His father asked me to take a look at a book that Daniel had written called The Talent Code, and I have finished that, and it has got me very, very excited. What I like so much about it is that he's begun to look at how we learn and draw some direct correlates as to what we're learning about brain research, how our neurons work, and I'll give you a little hint. It's all not the synapses that we think it is. There's a little bit more we need to understand about myelin, the coating around these axons, and it's fascinating reading. It's great. Will be a great discussion, and it'll help us all understand a lot more about how our brains work and how we can learn, how we get habits, how and why habits are hard to unlearn, and why learning things very, very, very early in life give us a head start. So take your time, try to join us next week. I think it'll be a fascinating discussion with Daniel Coyle on his book, The Talent Code. Remind everybody, Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Speck generously volunteered her time today and engineered today's program, and Josh, manned the phones. Thanks for listening, especially those who took the time to call and email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.